It doesn't really need enough.
To pass that. You're going to go first. I'm going to exercise my authority.
First question. Who possesses authority in American modern Orthodox Judaism today?
I'm going to respectfully exercise my authority and defer to Rabbi Mitenki to start this question.
The traditional answer is the answer of Aseh L'chava, that everyone has a responsibility to find someone who is their authority. Unfortunately, in our time of egalitarianism, democratization, and even Google, the Aseh L'chava has been redefined. And so there's the practical question of who possesses authority, or who defines exactly the question is who possesses the authority. The authority is still possessed within the modern Orthodox world by both lay and rabbinic leadership. The responsibility of those areas within the community where lay have to turn to rabbis, unfortunately, has shifted drastically within the modern Orthodox community. Where rabbis turn to lay leadership exists, and that also has to be represented as well. And I think the one thing that I would add on to this and throw back to Rabbi Engel, I guess, who comes next in terms of age, is the idea of a wonderful article that Lichtenstein sets out of not too long ago on the question of that. I think you're here, can't you?
No.
You know, I've never had a problem with kids. Normally they tell me that they hear me at Rabbi Small. I think the other piece that needs to be just put into this conversation is that article from Rav Lichtenstein that I'm sure my learned colleagues are familiar with, where he asks about Das Torah. Das Torah, when I used to ask Rabbi Schwartz about Das Torah, Rabbi Schwartz would say to me, I don't know what Das Torah is, but if you want my opinion on it, I'm going to share it with you. Rav Lichtenstein, on the other hand, says there is a concept of Das Torah within the modern Orthodox world, within the Torah world. The only question is, that there are not people who are able to really bear that mantle. His question is, how many Shlomo Zalmans are there in the world today? There are very few people, unfortunately, with the question also of authority, who have that worldview that we demand within the modern Orthodox community. There are tremendous Talmidei Chachamim throughout the world. How many of those Talmidei Chachamim also have an understanding of modernity, the understanding of the world, and the understanding of where the Baal HaBatim are coming from, and not where they want the Baal HaBatim to be, unfortunately continues to shrink. And so who possesses the authority? I think Baal HaBatim possesses authority, rabbis possess authority, who possesses rabbinic authority in the community with Das Torah is a very small group of people.
Great, it's good to be here with you. Thank you so much, Rabbi Dr. Ella, for inviting me and us. Just picking up on what Rabbi Mitenki spoke about a moment ago, and I largely concur. The phraseology of questions is something that I try to analyze when I come to provide some kind of answer or direction. I don't know if it's a question of possesses. I don't know that it ever was a question of possesses. I think in almost all circumstances, authority has been earned. Possession is something you can hold on to. But something that is earned means there needs to be some kind of ratification by the people. Maybe call me a creature of habit here, but that dynamic is already on display, believe it or not, even in Parsha Korah. It's a reality. What is the authority? Who is the authority, and who for whom do they speak? Particularly when we talk about American modern Orthodox Judaism, I'm very much indebted to Rabbi Dr. Eliphaz, excellent reader. That's your plug for today on the book. Now, you brought a copy of from the middle of reading this book, Modern Orthodox Reader, Excellent Modern Orthodox Judaism. You know, discount today, good. I get no credit. Who's in? Who's out? Who's the authority who's deciding what the definition of this modern Orthodox Judaism, Orthodox Judaism altogether is? So not only is it earned, but as Rabbi Tanki just pointed out, in terms of the Aseh L'Charav dimension, it's who do you choose? I was struck by one thing that I found in this book, among many gems in this book, which is that there are not only pieces in this book written by rabbis, but by lay leaders, and sometimes up-and-coming lay leaders. So when I opened this book and I read about an attack on Torah Umada from Yeshiva University, an attack on it by a professor who was a visiting professor in the United States from Bar-Ilan in 1988, I was struck that one of the entries here called Trashing Torah Umada, which was a vigorous defense of Torah Umada, was written by my good friend Dov Pinchot from Skokie, Illinois. And in that entry, he wants to, as part of the manner that he seeks to defend Torah Umada, he wants to Torah Umada, very basically the synthesis between Torah and general culture, much to say on that subject. He actually mentions the Mara D'Asra, the certain Russian yeshiva, souring rejection of the yeshiva's philosophy by certain Russian yeshivas in affront to the Mara D'Asra of Yeshiva University, Rabbi Norman Lamb. And in this article, he quotes that Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Wadi President Rabbi Lamb, and Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein as three exemplars of those values. It's interesting that sometimes the authority actually is whoever the people decide to confer the authority upon, and people who have earned it in turn. It's not a question of possessing, but it's a question of, I think, a willing laity deciding in the modernity of their own free volition to still endow themselves with the Torah. And when I think about religious authority for myself, I feel standing on the shoulders of giants. I think about my variety of Brian Lichtenstein's and so on. I think about Soloveitchik, Yosef Roshaber Soloveitchik's itself, Bahadur Ben Chaim Ben Chaim, or Gedalia Schwartz, in our own community, should have a Furi Shlema, and others, some ideas to think about. We talk about possession versus earning. We talk about what defines American Orthodox community, and when we speak about how that is conferred or earned, we're actually speaking about particular personalities that we as a laity have decided to confer the titles upon, no formal way, but an informal authority of influence.
Maybe one comment on each of the previous comments. In terms of Rabbi Matenki's note about Aseh L'Charav, so I think it's really a challenge to all of us collectively. It's a challenge to each of us individually. There's another prominent scholar of our day, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter, who published an article, I think it was in a recent tribute to Rabbi Sachs. They had a memorial, an honorary, one of these fest strips for Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, where he talks about the challenge of autonomy. You know, today, right across the street here from Skokie Yeshiva's Starbucks. So I don't drink coffee, but I've been to Starbucks, and I've seen it take, I would say, maybe 15 minutes for a person to order a cup of coffee. One cup of coffee. Because first of all, they have a sequence of Italian names for the sizes of the cups. That's what they start with. Then they have a whole, of angles, which Reverend Dank actually has done this. But you've got this down to a science. You,
it's
10 seconds. Exactly. So in today's day and age, unless you're a seasoned visitor to a Starbucks, there's so many choices, and we're accustomed to choices, and we are expecting that we're going to have a lot of choices because we decide. You know, in the realm of healthcare, the patient decides. You know, the notion that the doctor is an authority, I'm not sure how much that holds sway at all in America today. Maybe the doctor is an advisor. Maybe he is a learned practitioner. But ultimately, we decide as patients what we want, and the choices of healthcare is ours. So all of a sudden now we are confronted with the question of religious authority. So Aseh L'Charav is not so easy, because when it comes to our healthcare, we're making our own decisions, and when it comes to our coffee, we're making our own decisions. So irrespective of who you choose, today, just to make a decision to say I will submit myself to the system of halacha, it's countercultural to say that there is an authority in the first place. And there is no such thing as just, you know, moral relativism, whatever I feel like today. So I think that's a significant thing that we need to think about. Forget who you choose. Is each one of us really prepared at whatever that point is to say, yeah, I'm going to make that commitment, I'm going to make that sacrifice? Because Rav Soloveitchik, according to Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik in his Catharsis essay, talks about the challenge. It's not easy to make that commitment when the halakha has a demand. Because the halakha is, in a certain sense, as he describes, it is authoritarian, not just authoritative. The halakha at some point demands, you know, many of us have seen this either in our own personal lives or in the lives of others around us. It's not so easy. So the hasilah around point, you know, we should think for ourselves. Are we really prepared to make that commitment to authority? Whatever the authority is, are we prepared? And it becomes more challenging the more we are enmeshed in a modern society where personal choice, autonomy, is primary. That's the first thing. And then in terms of what Rabbi Engel commented, so if you look in the book, you'll see a beautiful array of different pieces written by different people, lots of different perspectives. And one of the things that I think is important to keep in mind when you talk about authority, forgetting about who possesses it, you know, and how, is the balance, the weight that's given to different opinions. You know, what is an authoritative opinion on a certain matter? Now, I was at a conference once. I was listening to someone present, a particular scholar, and he was presenting, it was not in a religious context, it was in a legal context, and he presented an essay that he was writing to present based on a diuk in the Rambam. And even as, I'm not a degree expert in the Rambam, just as a basic learned individual, it was obvious, as any Ben Yeshiva would know, that diuk in that Rambam was patently ridiculous. Absolutely untenable. So there was another member of the panel who probably skewered this scholar and pointed out that the opinion was totally spurious. And he responded by saying, I'm not saying this is the pshat in the Rambam, I'm saying it's a possible reading of the Rambam. So that means that you could say something that's, in today's day and age, you can publish on the internet, something that is completely and utterly false, but it's in the marketplace of ideas. And who's to say that it's not right? Who is to give more credence, more weight to, you'll open the volume and you'll see a piece from Rav Soloveitchik, and then you'll see a piece from some other very nice person. I'm not going to disparage any of the authors in the volume. Very nice person. But it's very important that we know how to balance and measure the weight, not necessarily authority, but the weight of these opinions. You have very well-meaning individuals, but they're not necessarily scholarly. A couple of years ago, we had the privilege in Skokie of welcoming Dr. Schneer Lyman. So Dr. Lyman was here for Shabbos. He was in Otoro for Shabbos. So we had the privilege of hosting him in our home for Shabbos lunch. He's a relative of ours. So at the Shabbos table, Schneer made a comment, a brilliant comment. He said, today we need graduate schools more than ever. I said, why? What do you mean by that? He said, because in graduate school, you don't learn information. You learn methodology of analysis. Today, there's a ton of information out there. Open the book, you'll see everybody has an opinion. Go on the internet. I listen to Rav Engel to know what's going on in the blogs. So I don't know what's going on, but apparently everybody has something to say. So Dr. Lyman's point was, well, only a trained academic knows how to analyze the information. It's not just about how much information you know, it's about understanding how to analyze it. So when it comes to Talmidei Chacham, when it comes to opinions, so you'll open the book, you'll see lots of different opinions, but you have to know, you have to be scholarly enough to know whose opinion carries greater weight than other opinions that exist. Just nice opinions, but they don't carry the same measure of weight. Was certainly not that authority.
I remember the hardest part about being a reader is that you have asked for permission. And 168 times, and you asked somebody for permission to publish a historical document. And it was about a month and a half before Rubenstein passed away. And he wasn't well at all, couldn't come to the phone, so I asked Dr. Tobin for permission to publish these two or three pieces of an environment ring. And she asked me to call her back in a week. I called her up, said, I've been waiting for you, so very Boston accent. I've been waiting for you, she tells me. See, I thought about it. My husband, he's a superstar. He probably saved 99% of the people in the book. Which I was totally respecting, that because the other one was kind of in the problem. She said, how'd you know? It's true that there needs to be, and she did give me permission because there's a difference between an ideological book and a history book. And she trusted that you have the right commentary and you got it there, so I didn't mind. So the people in the commentary does guide me forward. But very, very interesting. The only other thing I'll add is in 1840, the first ordained rabbi came to America, Rabbi Abraham Rice, or probably Reese, he pronounced it in German. And he arrived at the Baltimore announcing as the chief rabbi of the Jews, which all the other Israelites of Baltimore responded, we don't have a chief rabbi. This isn't Europe after all. We believe in use of term, but in a religious pluralism, separation of church and state. By then, actually, Maryland was the last to really separate church and state, the so-called Jewville in the 1820s. So what we're speaking about now, just as a reminder, it's really a condition about the modern experience in America, where authority is earned. And there is a conversation and dialogue between all different parties. However, it doesn't work. It's very different than being appointed. So it makes it a much more complicated affair. One that maybe is most difficult and poignant in 2016, but one that has frustrated and animated much conversation in the past 200 years. Next question.
I just wanted to add one other piece to this that I've been turning over my mind for a while. I've been referenced before this book that Rabbi Lamb wrote called Torah Umada. He wrote it in the late 80s. And it's meant to be an articulation of the synthesis between Torah and general culture. Unlike other Yiddish like Torah Das, which essentially sounds almost the same, it didn't articulate such a philosophy as such. Lamb thought it was important to put it together. And he wrote it up. He had different models for how he thinks we can reconcile the two and synthesize them. Anyway, the most recent edition of this book that was released just a few years ago by Koren has an afterword by Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, right there. But it does a good question there. Possesses authority. You respect him because he's the chief rabbi of the British Commonwealth, or because of his writing and teaching, or a combination of both? Okay. So he has an afterword in there, and he poses the following question. Rabbi Lamb wrote a beautiful book. It's got great models in it. How come there aren't more people who are just flocking to this synthesis? How come so many people are choosing one polarity over the other? How come it's so unbalanced? Here's what he says. When Rabbi Lamb wrote this book, he was talking about the engagement with general culture in terms of its intellectual ideas. Mada is knowledge. Mada as general culture, the best of culture, etc. But what he didn't put into the book, except to mention it by, is that it's actually also a culture of modernity. So Rabbi Sachs quotes, he said, this is the one paragraph, six lines long. This sums up, Rabbi Lamb is already touching on one of the main issues here that has less to do with the world of ideas and much more to do with the world of behavior or basic assumptions. Here's what he wrote. He said, here are the salient elements of the culture Rabbi Lamb defines follows. Modern culture, the substitution of experience for tradition as the touchstone of its worldview, a rejection of authority, at the very least a skepticism toward it, at worst a revolution against it, a radical individualism, and thus a preoccupation of the self, a repudiation of the past and orientation toward the future, secularism not as a denial of religion as much as an insistence upon its privatization, and a rejection of particularisms of all sorts, and an affirmation of universalism, the dream of the Enlightenment. I think if Rabbi Lamb was writing that paragraph today, he would add one other word, which is egalitarianism. And I would add it, Rabbi Sachs says, we're living in a time where these ideas are not just in the zeitgeist, in the thoughts of people, of highbrow literature and philosophy and science, but actually represents how so many of us
feel a certain tension with the modern culture. It's a feature of the time in which we live, and it impacts us. And so he writes, this is not abstract. This is the heart of the dilemma of the Jew in modernity. And as Rabbi Lam himself admits, when he wrote this book, and he's put in the third preface to the third edition, that this one that just put out, says he quoted, he likes to quote that quote in French, the more things change, the more things stay the same. La plus ça change, la plus ça reste la même chose. Right? What is it? What does it mean? He says, when I came to Yeshiva, most people didn't care about these intellectual questions. And now I wrote the book, and most people didn't care about these questions. People, kids who went to the school. And now he says, I'm writing third preface. I don't think most people care or animated by this. But I'm going to tell you the philosophies. Anyway, here's the reissue of the book. But by the by, so many of us live, much less with the world of Kant and Nietzsche, and so much more with the world of fill in some popular person, popular culture, or politician who emerges in the world of popular culture, or some such thing. And we live at that. And that more animates who we are and the culture in which we live.
In the past, historians and Orthodox Judaism often relied on a binary of resistors and accommodators who patrol the interaction between Jewish and American culture. We still see a very simple binary in one to either a resistor or accommodator today, or is it perhaps more complicated in the 21st century?
I'll call my copy. Oh, you'll speak. Great, go ahead.
Oh, I don't want to speak again.
Exactly, let's keep going. Keep going.
No, this is long. This is my teacher, Professor Jeffrey Murdoch, who was then, of course, yeah. He wrote this article, the article about resistors and accommodators, an 88-page article. It's fascinating reading.
You're reading all 88 pages?
I read it. No, I'm going to start on page one, and we're going to take a break. No. So I just wanted to say, he wrote this article about the varieties, resistors and accommodators, varieties of Orthodox rabbis in America, 1886 to 1983. So he defines, he thinks that the accommodators, the resistors, were attempted to reject acculturation, disdain cooperation with other American Jewish elements, fearing alliances would work to dilute traditional faith and practice, and that the accommodators accept the seeming inevitability of Americanization, they joined arms with less traditional elements in the community to perpetuate the essence of ancestral faith. It's way more complicated, I think, in the postmodern period. But I think the same trends still exist. You still have people who, generally, their tenor is, were at war, were in battle, man the barricades, and everything is viewed as a threat and a looming disaster. They see things as a cataclysm that's just around the bend. And other people who feel they have to run in, hook, line, and sinker, and our job as rabbis, teachers, as community, is bringing the people, whatever it's going to take, and to run the gamut, whatever it takes, to make accommodations for Americanization. To me, the landscape is a lot more complicated. Those are two caricatures. I think it's a lot more complicated today because of the fact that modalities of dress are much more variegated. I don't just mean physical dress, but I mean also in terms of how people present themselves, the intellectual engagements that they have, the exposure, certainly the internet here is a big factor in terms of people's involvement, either as accommodators or resistors. And I'm more concerned today than I was 5 years ago about the manner in which the accommodationist side of the ledger has perhaps started to gain steam in a manner that may be less than healthy. And I'll do that from ellipsis. Now someone has to take it. That's it.
I think the difference is between what was is that we don't get clear lines anymore. So when Rabbi Rebbe was chosen as the first president of Yeshiva University, Yehudas Rabbani, the people he was concerned about, later, when Rabbi Belkin was chosen, they were concerned about the RCA and the Yehudas Rabbani. There were two separate camps, and there were nice lines that were drawn. Today, within each of the groups, you have accommodators and resistors. And so, in Yehudas Yisrael today, they've adopted many of the behaviors that we used to define as modern Orthodoxy, whether it's college education, the types of professions that are chosen, even the types of vacations that they'll take. within the modern Orthodox world, will find just as well the resistors, the people who are becoming, and I don't mean this in the political sense, but viewing themselves as the real Naturae Carta, defenders of the city, that this is the way it was, this is the way it has to be, this, if we don't do this, this is what might happen. And so I still think the two terms are legitimate terms. I still think it's different way, that it's one of the ways to look at it. But it's within modern Orthodoxy today, there are resistors and accommodators. Whereas once it was viewed more that the resistors were to the right, the accommodators were within the modern Orthodox camp, it's become much more complicated. I was thinking even about this room. There are three times, this is the fourth time I've spoken in this room in my life. The first time was when we used to hold the B'nai Akiva Yom HaTzmaut down in this room. The second time was for the Shloshim for Rav Hirschler, who made sure that we got the Yom HaTzmaut in here. And the last time was most recent, when this became the high school of this Medrash, and Rabbi Yaakov Glasser of the CJF, the Center for Jewish Future, was here in town, and he spoke with the high school students as well. There was a time where those events wouldn't necessarily take place all together in one room, but if I look at it historically, we find today that as all the wonderful things happening in our community, I'm not sure Yom HaTzmaut will be taking place in this room the same way. I'm not sure that Rav Hirschler would be recommending a Rav Hirschler, but I'm not sure all of the Rosh Hashivas would fall into line the same way. We have resistance within our modern Orthodox camp here within this institution. We find resistance within the RCA that I had privileged to lead for a couple of years. We had that. And then on the other side, we had the accommodators. Not really.
Oh, I like that.
He's not an accommodator, but he did make sure that he had to speak in French just to show off.
Always the French.
Always the French. The French are the biggest accommodators in the world.
Yeah. And I would share with him a concern regarding the accommodators in all of the camps. Because the accommodation today is something very different than the accommodation of the years ago. We're accommodating to a culture, you know, we talk about it all the time, that when we talk about Torah and modern Orthodoxy, we are trying to work with culture. We're trying to take advantage of the general knowledge of the beauties of the natural and human effort. The problem is that what's out there today is not as beautiful as it once was. And so when I try to accommodate the beauty of Shakespeare, it's very different than accommodating the lyrics to rap music today. And so the accommodators today, while are accommodating something that's much more dangerous, because the culture today that's being accommodated is different. So resistors, accommodators, I think those still exist. I think they exist within individual segments. It's not defining them again, not only that condition, any of the other things that are Orthodoxy. And I think the resistors within modern Orthodoxy, this is the last point, and I'll pass it up to Rabbi Grant, I think much of the resistors of modern Orthodoxy are resisting an accommodation that is much riskier than it once had been. It's not a combination of higher culture. It's a lot more lower culture that's out there. And those who are accommodating that present that have engendered also the resistors within.
The word binary is very stark. It's like saying the word never or always. Like imagine somebody, they live on the East Coast, they say, I would never live in Chicago. And then all of a sudden they end up living in Chicago. Like, I didn't say that in the first place. But you say, I would never leave Chicago. And then all of a sudden you have an opportunity. Okay, maybe you would never leave Chicago. I think. But somebody theoretically might say, they would never leave Chicago. And things happen. The notion of binary, you know, Tzvei Dinim in the Gemara, it's usually used just as a frame of reference. There's a continuum, and that question of how often we accommodate and how often we resist is something that changes with the times, and it's not necessarily defined by the person. A person could one day be an accommodator, and another day be a resistor. I don't know. Was Rav Soloveitchik Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik? Was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zichronim Levracha? Were they accommodators or resistors? Well, frankly, it depends what, probably what time of day, what issue they were talking about. But I don't think you could speak of people and put them in a box and say always or never. There's no such thing. It depends on what's happening. I think it's more complicated than just one or the other. I think it depends on the person. And then the question becomes, in terms of the label, and this is something that I think is important to put out there, while the title of the book is Modern Orthodox Judaism, I'm not sure, put this out as a question, I'm not sure how much the term Modern Orthodox, how much utility that has. You know, what's the purpose of using that label? There is a question as to why we should use that term, if we should use that term. I can tell you, when I speak about the kolel, I don't think historically, I don't think I've ever used the words Modern Orthodox about our kolel. Ever. Was Rav Lichtenstein Modern Orthodox? I mean, he's in the book, so he's definitely...
He's Seikon.
That's what he calls, exactly, centrist Orthodox. So it's a question. The question Rabbi Mitenke just spoke about the difficulty of navigating a more complicated world now than it used to be. So it's doubly difficult when you talk about nuance. Right, so one issue is that the outside world is more complicated. The other issue is, in a role of leadership, how do you convey nuance? Rav Lichtenstein, the Tzaddik Livracha, he came to Chicago not too long ago for one of his visits, and he did an armchair conversation in someone's home. And someone asked him about higher secular education. So, for those who are not familiar, Rav Lichtenstein himself attended Harvard in his graduate studies. So Rav Lichtenstein gave, as he was wont to do, like 100 caveats before going to secular college. He spoke about how he had a personal chavrusa with the Rav several hours a day as a condition of going to Harvard. He spoke about he had already learned for several years in YU, and he had already been very well tutored, etc., etc. And what was the comment that somebody made when they left that armchair evening? Oh, Rav Lichtenstein said it's fine to go to Harvard and secular college. So while Rav Lichtenstein was trying to articulate nuance, which you need to do when you're oscillating between resisting and accommodating, but oftentimes the message, the mass message that's being communicated, the nuance is lost. So the question of how to be an accommodator and a resistor, when you're trying to convey nuance, it's harder. It's more difficult.
In July 1990, a prominent Rosh Yeshiva, who was Rabbi Ari Ginsberg of Palestine and Queens, identified the major points of difference between the so-called rightists and the modern Orthodox this term. They included religious Zionism, the study of secular ideas, and dialogue with conservative and reform leaders. Are these still the fault lines?
He's doing a great job of opening. He's doing a great job. Oh no, you got this is terrific. All right. I'm not sure.
The so-called rightists are, or the non-orthodox are, exactly what Janet just pointed out. You know, these terms are very, they're just very, very hard to parse. They really are. Which is why I also look to personalities for these kinds of things. Personalities that I myself, growing, learning, continuing to seek guidance from, in some cases, yeah, in fact, including posthumously, I've mentioned a few times when I was looking things at Sal. So just cycling through his reading, his writings and the like. But yes and no, are these little fault lines? Sure, and no, of course not, both at the same time. You know, the study of secular ideas, I mean, are people who are so-called rightists, again, what is that? What does that mean? Do they not study, they don't read a newspaper, they don't know anything about what's going on in the world, they're not involved in the fields of medicine or economics or whatever it might be. I don't know what to make of it. It's very hard. We spoke about this, what Rabbi Mitenke was speaking about before, with the accommodators and resistors. The world in which we live, the postmodern world in which we live, the lines are so much more fluid.
I wouldn't say it's the study of secular ideas. I'd say it's the valuation of general culture of secular ideas, qua secular ideas. Okay, the lit design of them? Sure. Some of them are lit designist. How is that expressing itself? I live in Skokie, Illinois. I love Israel. So I talk to fellow Jews and they love Eretz Yisrael. The difference is a difference in liturgy, to be sure. Both weekly, it's certainly differentiated. Yom HaSmaut, Yom Yerushalayim, which I consider to be a very important phase of celebration. But how many Jews are living and learning now in Eretz Yisrael in yeshivas? This is a question I have to people who don't have any religious line of leading. I ask them, as Mori Rabbi Yehuda Amital used to point out, since the days of Rabbi Akiva, never were there so many Jews sitting and learning Torah in Eretz Yisrael. So, we say religious Zionism really makes some kind of ideology that there's religious significance to the state of Israel. Okay, so on that score, I suppose that's a difference. We're drawing these are broad lines. You shouldn't really draw this way. Dialogue about the written form? I don't know what you mean by dialogue. I mean like the JUF mission. I've participated in a few times. Thank God it was able to go on. And we're sitting in different meetings. We're really actually committed. Sir Michael Walensky is with us this morning. Thank the co-chair of that, one of his colleagues. So, okay, so we mean dialogue about theological issues. So there I go, what can't you put me in? I'm involved in dialogue about theological issues with conservative and reformed Jewish people. They want to speak about halacha, that has to be my basic assumptions. I can't step out of that. That's my basic axiology. I'm not prepared to have discussions with people on theological issues we don't share the basic language of. But I am prepared to talk with them about anything having to do with the modern clock, anything to do with the Jewish people, to do with Israel, anything having to do with people, the social issues and the like, and frankly to engage in respectful dialogue on that score. I think it's good. I just don't like to get together with my relatives at my Shabbos table and fight with them about things we already know we don't see eye to eye on, and we've already parted companies so distinctly. I'm struck by the fact, and this is maybe the watchword from 1990 till today. You know what's missing here? I can't imagine how it could be missing by my lights in 2016. But in 1990, maybe Rabbi Ginsburg and Paul Stein didn't think of this idea, but it doesn't mention women, Seder Nashim. Does not mention here anything about women's Torah study. Doesn't put it, it's not mentioned. I'm not sure why it was left out. Maybe that's a sign of the times, or maybe it's a sign of Rabbi Ginsburg really is not even considering a category, but I think that's also an area that also has been a lot more engagement and involvement within all of the Jewish people in terms of learning and in terms of women's learning and advancement in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Two comments that Rabbi Engel just shared. One is the question of the, as Rabbi Tanki said before, and Rabbi Engel just said now, in terms of a lack of clear, so to speak, boundaries. One way to look at this might be the question of black and white versus more nuanced. That some communities and some leaders, both rabbinic and lay leaders, look at things in a more black and white way, kosher or treif. And if it's not kosher, it's chaz or treif, as opposed to looking at things in a more nuanced way. But the other thing I would note is the opposite, which is, because these things are so much more blurred, as Rabbi Metanki said, in terms of even style of living, so maybe we should spend less time trying to figure out exactly what are the tiny little nuanced differences that divide us and start building walls based on these particular small issues that we just figured out, like, and maybe we should just try to figure out how we have so much in common. You know, sometimes I think that when we have these kinds of conversations, so they descend into like a sociological and maybe historical discussion about, you know, these people do this and these people do that, which takes away from the whole center of the enterprise, which is our Avodas Hashem. Like, if we're supposed to be focusing on Avodas Hashem, then the conversation should be about, okay, in what way do we maximize, to borrow a term from another figure in this realm that by Michael Rosenzweig, should do well, uses that term very often, how do we maximize our Avodas Hashem? And so if we do that with a heavy dose of Avos Yisrael, then sometimes these conversations, instead of descending into like the particulars of how we're different, we realize that to a great extent we have a lot of the same. Now, it's sometimes hard to have a conversation. If you're nuanced and somebody else is black and white, then they're always making you black or white. So then it's hard to have those conversations. But if the focus is on building a community of Torah and raising the level of Torah and the type of embracing Torah that we have, so I think it's a different focus of the conversation. So,
Rosh Hashiva Chofetz Chaim is a great man. I would say nuance,
the role of authority and the idea of the Das Torah, to me, those are the two greatest differences between our world and other worlds.
I'm going to go off script. Something that your grand said is very interesting to me. I'll stick with other Rashi name dropping, but Chaim Dov Keller in Taos in 1970, a graduate of Yeshiva College. He read Rabbi Lam's essay about the modern Orthodox identity crisis and trying to come up with a label, and said, I think it lives in the Jewish observatory, the Gouda organ. And Rabbi Lam explained, thank goodness, now I know with whom I am speaking. I am the Orthodox right, Rabbi Rachman is the Orthodox left, and Rabbi Lam is the modern Orthodox. So he's somewhere in the center, and it offered at a time when people needed to build very tall walls to establish the boundaries and the rules of engagement. And the question that I think both Rabbi Brand and Rabbi Engel, perhaps more than Rabbi Brand, have expressed this morning is, what exactly are the utilities of such a thing, of those designations? At certain points, if we were having this discussion 30 years ago, I'm not sure if we would eschew these designations that we do today. And as I'm thinking, historians make it allow me as the prophets, I promise. As we think about moving forward today, well, what is the point? Is there something about today, I'll use Rabbi Engel's term, the fluidity of our community today, which makes it so that we don't want to, it's not a problem, brand, a title, a designation. Because 30 years ago, if there were one Yitzhak, probably by contractual obligation, they'd have to call themselves a modern Orthodox Kolom now. Not at all. And what is the point? Does it create greater harm than good?
First of all, I was involved in the contract with YU and Kolom. It doesn't say that. And it never came up in any of those conversations.
Which is the sign of the times.
Yes. But I also think that the titles are important, even though they're imprecise, because they help in providing identity. One of the challenges that we have as a modern Orthodox community, unfortunately, is we're always looking to our right and our left, and we seem to look a little more at the left, lately, the more concerned that maybe we're losing some direction. But we need to have a sense of pride. And identity comes with ID, with the idea of a title and a term. It may be that modern Orthodox is a lousy term. There was this whole fight over centuries during that I see modern Orthodox. Someone once gave me a hint. It was almost a mystery hint. What's the difference between centuries and modern? It's not a great term, but it is something that is important because we have an important brand to really be proud of. We also have an important brand to be proud of, but we have an important brand to be proud of, and we need
it's French. It's nothing like French.
Yeah,
it's not French.
And we need. So I'm actually in favor of titles. I'm not in favor of titles traditions. Then, you're this, you can't do that. I'm in favor of titles to be able to help us formalize, clean out, and how we are different.
Just to follow up on that, so you reminded me, a few years ago, we have a couple of classes in the shul. The title of the classes was, What is Modern Orthodoxy, and Why Are We Still Asking This Question? Right? And so I, the first year, so to speak, was about these points that we're talking about now. You know? And I said, look, I consider myself modern Orthodox. I heard a story about someone who described to one of my colleagues that he loves to come to shul, and he said he lives many suburbs away from where the shul is on Shabbos. So the rabbi said to him, oh, you stay over in the neighborhood? He said, no, I drive. So I said to him, look, you know, okay. He didn't say anything. He said, don't worry, rabbi, it's okay to drive because I'm modern Orthodox. So, you know, I realized, wow. So it's the benefit of having a loose terminology is the big tent. The downside is, you've left the definition very wide
ranging for people to define it as they would like to. And why are we still asking this question? There's a question there. Why is there some existential angst that, let's figure out who we are? The person kept saying, I don't know who I am. They have to go, to seek some professional counseling. Who am I? I want to know. Hopefully professional counseling comes from authorities, people who are of stature and the like, as the college mentioned. But do you realize the moment that we're living in is a moment in which the very word identity is totally up for grabs? I went to a presentation last week at the RCA, mental health professional speaking, and she presented to us that you shouldn't speak anymore in popular culture, generally in the public square, about male and female. Maleness and femaleness. That's ad kedekah, the moment that we find ourselves in, right? And I'll let everyone fill in the blank there. But identity, national identity, personal identity, gender identity, what next deconstruction will we find? So into that, I note maybe even generational divide between us, us sitting here, maybe different generational divide between myself and around my culture. But culturally, at a breakneck speed, what was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, not possible in the public square is today. I'm sorry, I'm not doing a fait accompli. That's how it is.
Yeah.
So just to consider that, and we're talking about this conversation, like the labels and that, and forth, the world has moved to a place where everything we thought about basic assumptions, about something as basic as gender, is already the highbrow approach is already, well, we should speak about it also as a continuum and not actually in a definitional manner. Because after all, that would be against the ethos of inclusion and egalitarianism. Okay.
Dad?
I'm scared now. What are you going to add?
If your label, should come with a picture. So if your label comes with a picture, if you close your eyes and your label, whatever you want to use that label is, let's say for me, watching Rav Lichtenstein daven Maariv on a Wednesday night. If that's what your label looks like, I think it's probably a good label. If the label that you're using is the depiction of someone whose commitment to putting Avodas Hashem, the Ribbono Shel Olam, their Yiddishkeit, at the center of who they are, and it's more on the periphery, they're more engaged in not the secular studies, but the secular culture, and that picture looks like, and let's be very clear about it, that picture looks like a Shabbos with somebody dressed in undignified clothing who saunters into shul at some ungodly hour, ish kaddish over Aleinu Tamid, and then their afternoon looks like a barbecue on July 4th. If that's your image of your label, that's very distinct from the Lichtenstein daven Maariv on a Wednesday night. And I think we should be careful when we choose our labels. We should make sure that the label has a tagline. So my label is from Lichtenstein daven Maariv on a Wednesday night, which I've witnessed many times. And that image in your mind can inspire you to great kibbutz elokim. It's an unbelievable image. And I think that's what we want to try to project in our community. In the book, there's an essay about whether the Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik, studied secular studies or not. Of course he studied secular studies. Everybody knows that. He had a PhD, he studied secular studies. But the image in your mind of Rav Soloveitchik is a man not holding a book of philosophy. Although he taught philosophy, Rav Schwartz, he told us that he went to Rav Soloveitchik's classes in philosophy. But that's not your label, that's not your picture. Your picture of Rabbi Soloveitchik is a man with a Shas Gemara, with a page of notes about a Rambam. That's your picture. So we want to create a picture in our community. So it doesn't matter. I mean, to me, I'm not so into the labels. I'm more into the imagery. And if our imagery looks like us, people who have PhDs, experts in Milton, who are davening Maariv on a Wednesday night like it's Kol Nidre, that's a good picture, that's a good label for me.
very good point, particularly people who had this conversation or Tank or Angela or Graham. I learned a lot. I have to go and revise.
this new book.